papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about what's going on in the news media these days and about some of the issues that arise for newsroom decision makers. I'm Rex Smith, creator of The Upstate America and formerly editor of The Times Union, with my colleagues here, Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and Ira Fussfeld. So, Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of The Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. What's on your mind today?
Well, a lot of things are on my mind, but I guess you just want to talk about media.
Yeah. What are you thinking you want to talk about?
I haven't been here in a while, so I got to refocus. You know, I think all four of us here were raised on the concept of objectivity in your journalism, that a story should not show any bias, that it should be information for the edification of the readers. And I'm interested in learning that that's not necessarily what many journalists believe is the way to go. So perhaps we can discuss that.
Okay, great. The dying sense of objectivity. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of The Saratogan and The Record of Troy. What are you up to?
I'd like to talk about, if we have time, the double-barreled questions that reporters ask that drives me crazy. You're asking, for example, the president two questions, knowing that you're not even going to get the answer to one.
It does seem kind of crazy. All right, we'll get to that. And Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, what's up with you today?
You know, we really need to talk about the withdrawal of federal funding for public media. I mean, we're sitting here in a public radio station, and we've talked about it before, but it seems to be barreling down the highway toward actually happening.
Yeah, I think that's right. It looks like this fall, in just a very few weeks, there will be $1 billion withdrawn from the public media system. While it will primarily threaten smaller public radio stations, it really touches the whole ecosystem because it's money that will not be going to NPR and PBS and will rob local stations of their impact. You know, it makes you wonder, what's the argument, I guess, for preserving it? I mean, we who have been involved in journalism for our careers would always have said, well, we don't want to have government funding because there is the risk that you could have the government dictating the terms of what you're doing. But, you know, that hasn't in fact been the case, certainly with NPR and with PBS. We've seen the value of independent journalism and the strong local support, local coverage that has been present on stations like WAMC and its ilk. And so raising that issue turns out to, I think, be a false flag. And what we're instead seeing is actually an attack on independent journalism that has been fair and aggressive. So I don't know what the alternative is. Where do we go from here?
Well, I always preface my comments that I'm a member of the board here on this radio station, have been for a number of years, although I don't speak for the board. So that having been said, the cut in funding is going to hurt all public radio stations. But most of the large ones, the mid-sized ones such as this one, will survive. But there will certainly be an impact. You'll have less money to spend, number one, money that was coming from the government to the local budgets. But beyond that, the content that is provided from the national offices of public radio is bound to be diluted. There's not going to be as much money for them to be spending on coverage. But I've always been of the belief that I would love for the public radio and television stations not to have to rely on the government for any kind of money. It just seems to me that it creates a circumstance where exactly what is happening now you want to avoid, which is the government telling a broadcaster what they can and can't spend. I don't know what the answer is, but I know that there are a lot of small public radio stations that are going to be endangered as a result of this.
Yeah, the little stations out in Unalakleet, Alaska, and Pendleton, Oregon, and Pierre, South Dakota, these are going to be significantly affected.
Yeah, and those areas have no other means of communications. And so kinds of crises reporting, flooding, floods, fires, etc., if that's not covered by them, nobody is going to be covering them.
You know, I this is part of a broader attack by the administration on the media in general, as it is perceived as elitist and, you know, East Coast focused or the coastal focus. And I think the main target would be NPR and not the small radio stations. Already there's a carve out for some of the Native American stations in the Dakotas, where you are familiar with. Mm-hmm. I expect what's going to happen to kind of stymie the outrage over this, that there will be similar carve outs. They will, you know, choose station by station and maybe somehow give these Congress representatives a pot of money to dole out some money to stations that they favor. It's very clear that they are giving, or they are taking the money away because they are unhappy with the coverage. We here would agree that we think their coverage is fairly good. Some people on the right wing think it's biased towards the left from NPR, but the local stations do these great jobs. I agree with Ira. It's tough to take, you know, if you take federal money, there's a danger it might be taken away. What I'm also worried about is the attack on the nonprofit status of these radio stations and what's going to happen with their licenses. The attacks are relentless. This is just the beginning.
I totally agree with Judy on all fronts. I share Ira's concern about reliance, even on a small percentage on government, because now you see what that can do to us, and we don't want to be beholden to government. And this is a broader attack on the believability of the news, on nonprofit status of public radio and other public entities. It's a real concern. It further denigrates the public trust in news. You don't need this news. You don't want this news. This is not news you should believe. And you're right, Judy, about the there will be those carve-outs, and I think that's how they were able to get votes from Republicans who are in districts where they really do rely on these stations for emergency news and other vital news.
So it's a small percentage directly. That is, NPR gets only about 2% of its annual budget directly from federal grants. For PBS, that's about 15%. So you cut out 15% of your funding. That's a big deal for public television. But all of these organizations, NPR and PBS, then get federal money indirectly through payments that these stations make. So like WAMC pays to NPR, right, to help support that funding.
And it's not an insignificant number. It's a big number.
So as that money evaporates, as WAMC loses its federal funding, that means it has less money to be able to make up for the hole in the NPR budget. So it's actually one cut feeds upon another and puts the whole system at risk. And we, you know, 20 years ago, it might have made a little bit less difference because commercial radio still was doing news. A lot of it was just headlines, but there was, when I became a full-time resident of the Capital Region of New York in the late 80s, there was still an all-news station on the AM dial here that went by the call letters WPTR. And I don't think it lasted into the 90s. And now, in almost all of the country, there isn't any real reporting being done on commercial radio. It just isn't sustained, which is why WAMC over the years acquired all these signals of small commercial radio stations that were out there available for sale because their owners had gone bankrupt. Strong journalism is being done by public media, but the audience for it is evaporating, I'm afraid.
Although I would say this, I presume that what we're experiencing at this radio station is not unlike what's being experienced elsewhere. And that is, for all the success that WAMC has in its fund drives three times a year, sometimes they go real quickly, sometimes it takes a little longer, and they get thousands of donations from people in this region or this seven-state region that this station reaches out to. It's still thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners to the station who don't give a dime. And if they never gave a dime before, now's the time. And it's 1-800-323-926.
We all know that.
Yeah,
But we all sleep with that number.
Give a dime.
But the point is, there are an extreme large number of people who do not pay anything into the station. And if that's going to happen long term, particularly when you add in the money that's not being provided by the government, it's going to be very dire indeed for public radio.
You know, this is a local media issue, both profit and nonprofit, because what I often clamor for is that if you consume local media, you need to support it with your money, whether or not it's the nonprofit radio station or if it's your for-profit weekly newspaper. The fact that that hasn't been happening to compensate for the loss of business advertising is a reflection on partly, you know, maybe we're not doing a good enough job, that we're not providing a product that's worthy to be paid for. But I think public radio, if people have it on all the time and rely on it for so much information, they need to really have a reckoning with themselves.
You know, one of the issues that is raised by the critics of public broadcasting is what goes to one of the topics that we wanted to talk about today that Ira mentioned, and that is the question of objectivity. People sometimes say, well, the problem is your reporting is biased. It's not objective. And, you know, it is an interesting question, that notion of objectivity. That's a word that has fallen out of favor in journalism because it sounds an awful lot like, on the one hand, on the other hand.
Both sidism,
right. More to the point, journalism over the last 30 years, really, good journalism has been saying our goal is to give people the truth, not just this side and that side.
But, I mean, I'm an old-timer. I was brought up in both sidism, and both sides are important to a story. And how much of each side you include in a story is a subjective decision that you're going to make. But nonetheless, the goal always was, when I was growing up, to provide an honest, fair, and accurate account of whatever it is you were covering. And you're right, there are people who believe that it's somehow biased one way or the other. But if something is not exactly meeting your expectation, then you're going to say it's biased. But it's more than likely just an objective story that is being reported fairly, and you don't like the fact that it's being reported fairly.
And in the both-sidism, sometimes there are just not two sides to a story. And I think that many of us in the media made a mistake years ago of trying to present a second, the other, quote-unquote, other side, when there really was not a legitimate other side. Climate change is an example, and I remember when one of your editors down in Kingston had, I thought, bravely said, okay, we're going to stop pretending that climate change is a debatable issue in their coverage and in the letters that they would run, that there aren't two sides to some issues.
Right, like child abuse. There's no two sides there. Dog abuse or animal abuse, no two sides there. You know, Terry Moran, the ABC News correspondent who was suspended, fired for a derogatory tweet about Stephen Miller calling him, I think, a dictator.
Oh, world-class liar, I think.
And so he has come out with a
so accuracy didn't count.
He said, we're deluded if we think that there is such a thing, a holy grail of objectivity. What we need to do as journalists is just present the facts and be as true and honest as we can be. And this younger generation of journalists, I think, are calling us older folks out on this one, saying that, you know, maybe we have been deluding ourselves about the fact that there could be such a thing as a totally objective story.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason we're bringing this up is that a story we've all been, we shared with ourselves, is that it suggests that younger journalists now do not believe in the concept of objectivity. And the debate in journalism circles is objectivity still the goal that we are reaching for, or is it an anachronism? And that's why this is all coming up right now. And it's the think tank among journalism people in the industry are having this debate among themselves.
It's one of these things about solutions journalism, is the idea is write the story with a solution in mind, or to at least talk to the people who might be coming up with solutions to a problem. Don't just report that there's a problem, report that there's a potential way to solve the problem. Not every story can be handled that way.
But when you can, I think that's a really valuable role. And I remember hearing my elder editors when I was a new reporter saying, well, your job is to tell the story, just report the facts, and then you let people take action based on what you've written, and they can decide how they want to handle it. And that's not being as useful a member of your community as you can and should be.
Yes, my favorite story of the failure of that approach stems from my early, after I'd just been at the Times Union a few months, I was managing editor for news, and I went up to the business council meeting at Lake George at the Sagamore Resort. Yeah. Very cool thing. I was moderating a panel, but the Times Union had a reporter there who covered the speech by Governor George Pataki. You know, I remember watching Pataki. He was a tall guy, you know, and he was stretching his arms out. He said that he had been governor for 9 months at that time. It was in September of the year that he'd become governor. And he was talking about how he had turned around the economy of New York State. Well, at that time, New York was the fifth largest economy of the world. And I remember him stretching out his arms. He looked like a bird about to take off. What a story! What a turnaround! And that was reported. The next day in the Times Union, it said the governor said he turned around the economy of New York State. And there was no effort in that story to say, what did he do in these 8 months that turned around the economy of New York State? So I wanted to do a story that would show, did we in fact turn around the economy of New York State? But I was just the managing editor. I wasn't in charge. We didn't get to actually do that story for 2 years. We eventually came back to it, and we found it. We talked to independent economists. What are the measures? What are the indices you would use to determine how the economy is doing? We found 7 different measures, you know, new housing starts, auto sales, different things that we would come in together. And we found out when we finally measured it, the last 2 years of Mario Cuomo's governorship and the first 2 years of George Pataki's, when we looked at them, actually on 5 of the 7 measures, the economy was doing better under Mario Cuomo than under George Pataki. Now, there are many factors that could have led to that, but it just showed that just quoting what somebody says is not giving readers the truth. And so when you say to people, a reporter is just supposed to give folks the facts, well, what is the fact? The fact is the governor said that, but the fact is not that he had, in fact, turned around the economy.
And even when you know better, that can be difficult to do, and it happens every day now. So how many claims have our listeners heard? I'll go back to President Trump or a governor, but Trump especially makes these declarations. This is the best that's ever been. Whatever it is, best thing that ever happened. And there is not a consistent blowback in a story. The stories don't put into context and tell the reality against what is being said.
You know, we've been talking about the objectivity and both sidism on this show for many years. I can recall on several occasions when our former colleague Alan Shartok would say, well, what's the other side of the Holocaust? In other words, if you're doing a story on that, it should obviously be slanted the way you would think it should be slanted. On the other hand, if you had the opportunity to get Adolf Hitler on the phone, would you not take advantage of it and find out what he has to say about what he's doing? I mean, isn't that both-sidism?
Well, I suppose, but you would then have to juxtapose what he says against reality.
Yes.
Which is what happens with Trump all the time. You know, we have Donald Trump, and I think what really angers him is that reporters do hold him to a standard of truth and are constantly pointing out that he lies as he breathes, frankly. So in pointing out his lies, I think that's why he hates the media and why a lot of his supporters are taught to hate the media as well. But what's the alternative? Is the alternative to let him rant? And that is what increasingly his right-wing media claque is doing.
Yeah, we may have reached a tipping point in this administration, given how his base is turning on him being Trump. And we'll have to see what's going to happen on that and how that could change the entire political landscape and the journalism landscape as well.
You're more optimistic than me.
Yeah.
Talking about Epstein.
Jeffrey Epstein post, yes, because he is changing the story that he's always had, right? And trying to get people to believe that it was the Democrats who have been trumpeting the Epstein story as opposed to Donald Trump himself.
And this is a good example of, as readers and listeners should be following that story and seeing how the stories are trying to put these new claims into context with reality.
Right. And there have been some who have been dissing the idea of even bringing up this story or challenging the president on his past positions. But man, this is not the most important story out there. There are wars happening. There are people starving. There are, you know, cuts being made to USAID to poor people throughout the world. But it's an important issue because it underscores his position with regard to his base and what his outlook is going forward. It seems to me like he doesn't even care about
it. It also speaks to the man's character.
Well, yeah.
Is he or was he, in fact, someone who was a pedophile on that island? Something happened on that island.
Whenever he talks, there's such a meandering conversation. There are so many facts he's putting out there that reporters can't keep up. I mean, how do you fact check one of these 45-minute rambles? He's challenging whoever appointed Jerome Powell. Well, he appointed Jerome Powell.
That's startling. As they say, let's look at the videotape.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm hoping somebody leaks the Epstein files to journalists. I want to see that list, man.
If it exists, if there is such a thing as a list. Hey, I wanted to get onto one more topic before we get to the double-barreled question. That is just this, because we are sitting here not far from the New York State Capitol, and there are a lot of journalists who cover state government. Here's an interesting survey. Only about 51 journalists at large state or regional news organizations responded, but these are all state government reporters, and here's what they found. 69% of the state government reporters said their greatest challenge is lack of access to records or people. 55% found it difficult to access public records, and two-thirds said that a colleague had been excluded from briefings by officials. A third said it had happened multiple times. It sounds to me like state governments are becoming a place where it's really hard to do good journalism these days.
You know, I wish there was a point of comparison. I wish they had done this survey 10 years ago so we could see, because it seems like it's always been a problem. Whether it's more so nowadays, and here in New York State, with every administration, it did get harder.
Yeah.
Maybe they just learned new tricks, but a point of comparison would have been helpful on that. Still, the fact that far more than a majority of reporters are saying, you know, they can't get people to talk to them, they can't get the records they need, in a society in which the free flow of information is essential for democracy.
Is there a lack of less access in the Capitol? I don't know how it used to work, but you used to be able to wander down the hall outside the governor's office.
Absolutely. You could, as a reporter in the Capitol, I did. You could wander into the lieutenant governor's office, for example. He didn't have very much to do. And you could talk to aides there and go.
Was that Malcolm Wilson?
No. Hey, my hair is white, but no, that would be Stan Lundeen.
Hell of a nice guy, by the way.
Absolutely. Lovely fellow. But you could walk into the governor's press office and confront the press aides who had just been distorting reality for you. So that is no longer possible. And especially, and we've noted this problem before, nowadays, an awful lot of interaction with reporters is done via email. And people will insist that you submit your questions in writing. That's ridiculous. Anyway, so what was this about double-barreled questions?
Oh, this was a quickie. There was a story about this on Pointer, the think tank about journalism. And the issue with double-barreled questions had to do with how reporters might ask Donald Trump two questions when they have a chance to ask one question. And what happens is neither question gets answered. My recommendation is that they stop doing that, that they ask one question, listen to the answer, and then pipe up with a follow-up question to the main question they wanted to get answered.
This is incredibly annoying. They did it in the Biden administration. They do it at any kind of press briefing. They'll ask two questions. And typically, the person answering the questions forgets one of the questions, being hit with two. I don't know what is motivating them to do this, but it makes us all look bad.
Probably the best advice is to ask short, open-ended questions that can't just be answered with yes or no. You know, that would be one little bit of advice. And ask one question at a time. See if we can get an answer to anything. So that's your little journalism lesson for the day, folks. And we've run out of time. We have to say that's the end of the Media Project for this week.
That can't be right.
It must be.
The show ought to be an hour.
It's fake
news. It's nice to have you back.
don't get used to it.
That's your objective opinion.
Ira Fussfeld of Kingston is here. Barbara Lombardo from Saratoga Springs. Judy Patrick from Greenwich, New York. And I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American. Thanks to our producer, Dave Gustina, and to you folks for joining us. Hope to see you again next week here on The Media Project.
Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustino. Thanks for listening.
Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.